Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. I'm pleased to welcome you to tonight's event with Michael Shorier. Tonight's event is co-organized by the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council on Northern California. I am Michael Carr, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your chair for tonight's program. It is now my distinct honor to introduce this evening's distinguished guest, Michael Shorier. Former chief of staff of the Central Intelligence Agency Bin Laden Unit and author of the new book, Osama Bin Laden. Michael Shorier is a 22-year CIA veteran. During his time at the CIA, starting from 1996 to 1999, he worked at the Osama Bin Laden Tracking Unit at the Counterterrorism Center and served as the chief of the Bin Laden Unit, known as Alex Station. He then worked as a special advisor to the chief of the Bin Laden Unit from September 2001 to November 2004. Mr. Shorier resigned from the CIA in 2004, and he's currently an adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a former senior fellow at Jamestown Foundation, where he regularly wrote for the Global Terrorism Analyst section of his online publication. Michael has published 4 books, Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Imperils, Hubris, Marching Towards Hell, and Osama Bin Laden. Mr. Shorier lives in Virginia with his wife and 2 children. Please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Mr. Michael Shorier. Thank you, sir.
Good evening, everyone, and I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club and the World Affairs Council of Northern California for having me a second time. I was here in 2008, which I suggest, or I suppose, means that Northern Californians are gluttons for punishment. I'd like to talk tonight a little bit about, a lot about Osama bin Laden, but also the role of individuals in history. I think our children, certainly my children, have been taught in school that individuals are less important than sort of anonymous forces, whether they're economic or political. And I think, if anything, bin Laden proves that any one of us, with proper diligence and certainly opportunities, can affect the world in a very serious way. To begin tonight, I would ask you to imagine that you're an eminent lawyer, preparing to argue a case before the Supreme Court, perhaps, and also to imagine that because you are a confident, experienced, distinguished, and usually successful lawyer, you decide to enter the court and present your argument without having troubled yourself to look up, read, and then study all of the written materials pertinent to the case. Indeed, so confident are you of prevailing that you did not even read the materials prepared for your use by your team of legal clerks. Now, this scenario is, of course, hard to imagine. A good lawyer, after all, presumably would not enter a courtroom to argue a case without thorough preparation. Likewise, it is just as hard to imagine that any American president would make the most important decision of his or her presidency, that is the decision to go to war, without first reviewing all available materials, written, graphic, or oral, in order to identify the enemy's motivation and goals. One would imagine that a president, not less than a lawyer, needs to know his opponent as well as possible. And yet I would argue that U.S. leaders have been waging a war against Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and their allies without bothering to study his words in a serious effort to absorb what the U.S. military calls the commander's intent. As a result, come next August, Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and their allies will have been waging a war in the United States for 15 years, and they will still be a basically unknown quantity to senior U.S. policymakers, politicians, generals, intelligence officers, and even so-called al-Qaeda experts in the private sector. That this is the case is purely the result of sloth or negligence or arrogance, because since formally declaring war on us on the 23rd of August, 1996, bin Laden has, at least in one way, followed the model of America's victorious North Vietnamese enemies, Ho Chi Minh and General Giap. Like our North Vietnamese vanquishers, bin Laden has made sure that the U.S. government and people have no credible excuse for failing to understand what motivates the war being waged against them by al-Qaeda and other Islamists. Through numerous statements, speeches, and interviews, bin Laden has explicitly explained the Islamists' grievances, their religious motivation, and their war aims. He has also helpfully provided us with metrics used by al-Qaeda to measure the progress of their war and has issued terms for ending the war. Bin Laden's words, moreover, have been plentiful and are increasingly accessible in English and other Western languages. My own archive, for example, on which the book was based, contains over 175 primary source documents, numbering over 840 pages. This is a significant amount of material, and yet the only reasonable claim that I can make about my own archive is that I hold only the documents I found to date, and surely not all that exist. Given this body of primary sources, it is odd that so few of them have been exploited by Western political leaders, writers, and analysts who have spoken on the bin Laden issue or produced books meant to explain who bin Laden is and what he is up to. To date, works on bin Laden, with a few notable exceptions, especially Peter Bergen's splendid book, The Osama Bin Laden I Know, have been based in the main on what other individuals have said about him and not what he has himself said and done. These other commentators can be divided into two batches. The first tend to be such enemies of bin Laden and al-Qaeda as the former Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki, the imprisoned but now supposedly reformed Islamist scholar, a man named Dr. Fadl, and the former Islamist and anti-Saudi firebrand, Sheikh Al-Auda, who now runs a website and a television channel for the Saudis. The second batch is found among former or current mujahideen who have fallen out with bin Laden for one reason or another. It is worth noting that the men in this latter group broke with bin Laden and now criticize him over strategy, tactics, timing, targets, or concern for the Taliban regime's survival, but none of them became his enemies. They still view him as an important, accomplished, and perhaps most dangerously for us, an inspirational Islamist leader. They differ with bin Laden over tactics and targets, but their ultimate strategic goal for the jihad are very comparable to bin Laden's. That is, to drive the United States from the Muslim world, to overthrow the Arab tyrannies, and to destroy Israel. While what bin Laden's enemies and former close associates have said about him is a major resource when analyzing his thoughts, talents, and character, it is not a sufficient base of data on which to develop a well-rounded assessment of the man. It is quite simply less than half the story. To accomplish the task of accurate understanding, what others say must be assessed alongside the primary documents. And yet, senior Western politicians, generals, policymakers, intelligence officers, and writers have largely failed to do so, often dismissing the primary documents as rantings, diatribes, and ravings, as if they really emanated from the imaginary madman so often described by U.S. presidents, British and European prime ministers, and Arab tyrants. It must be said that leading Muslim journalists and writers have paid much closer attention to bin Laden's words and especially his knowledge of and use of Islamic history, and by and large have produced more sophisticated and accurate portraits of him. Since 9/11, then, a score or more books have been written by Western and Muslim authors about bin Laden and al-Qaeda. In regard to bin Laden, these books have focused on his character, his intelligence, leadership talent, public speaking ability, international influence, and organization and modern management style. I believe that the best of the books were written by Peter Bergen and Steve Cole. Among the rest, there are a dozen or so books by Western and non-Muslim authors that have come to be categorized as essential works on bin Laden and al-Qaeda. In my new book, I have examined each of these books closely and noted the number of citations of primary documents, speeches, interviews, sermons, statements, and so on, that are contained in the author's footnotes. I have also noted where a large number of citations pertain to relatively few primary documents. I did not, of course, have access to electronic versions of the books. My count is derived from a line-by-line reading of each book's endnotes. Keeping score as I went. I do not claim that the accounts are exact, but they are quite close, and give a clear idea of the degree to which each author exploited primary sources. I'll not take the time tonight to go through the entire list, but will cite three of what are widely considered to be the best books about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and note how many of the 175-plus documents were cited. The first is an excellent book on al-Qaeda by a British author named Jason Burke. His book was called Al-Qaeda, Casting a Shadow of Terror. Five citations. Steve Cole's book, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan and Bin Laden. Two citations. Pulitzer Prize winner. Larry Wright's book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Another Pulitzer Prize winner. 28 citations, 22 of which were to four documents. This brief list shows, I believe, that despite the large body of primary documents at hand, few of them have been exploited by Western writers and analysts who have produced books meant to explain bin Laden and assess his intentions. The reason for this failure is not entirely clear to me, but it seems to pivot off the reluctance of some authors and most politicians to accept that in the early 21st century, the Islamic religion can possibly be the driving force and key motivation behind our Islamist enemies. Indeed, there seems to be an unshakable presumption that secularism will eventually triumph around the world and that only material gain, class interests, or other non-religious factors can be deemed to be real sources of motivation. In this worldview, religion is merely a cover for more measurable political, economic, and social motivations. These same individuals seem even more reluctant to face, or to at least publicly state, the fact that in the eyes of most Muslims around the world, Western policies and actions in the Islamic world are not benign and humanitarian, but are viewed as anti-Muslim and lethal. Finally, many contemporary historians, political scientists, and journalists tend to believe that the world is shaped, moved, and changed by more or less anonymous social and economic forces, be they globalization, capitalization, Marxism, or the now ubiquitous concept of hope, rather than what in a more realistic and thoughtful age were called great men. That this illogical and indeed indefensible mindset should be so strong and impervious to reality is remarkable, if not perverse, and is especially striking as we marked in the last month the 100th birthday of a truly great and world-changing American. The bulk of bin Laden's scholarship, moreover, is extraordinarily presentist. When Western authors encounter thinking or mores they consider anachronistic in the modern world, they default to asserting that ideas running counter to the tenets of secularism, multiculturalism, globalization, and diversity can only be held by limited numbers of medieval, violence-prone, pseudo-Islamic thugs. The predominantly secular authors, for example, hate the absence of women's rights in much of the Muslim world, and so Islamists are always arch-misogynists. The writers also hate the motivational power of Islam across the Muslim world, a power that indeed advises violence can be necessary to defend the faith, and so the Islamists are described as distorters of their religion. Most of all, the writers fear any threat to progress, and so, notwithstanding the heart-on-the-sleeve prose used by many authors, they prefer to combat the Islamists in several rather stark ways. By maintaining a status quo that features the Western defense of Arab tyrannies. Note the creeping sense of fear and worry among Western government and media as the so-called people power rebellion they have cheerled in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain take on a more Islamic cast and a threat of violence. They also approve of efforts to impose secular democracy on Muslims to neuter the Quran and the sayings and traditions of the Prophet, called the Sunnah, and thereby negate Islam's overwhelmingly martial doctrine of jihad. They also proceed to make claims that spreading Islamist violence is due to such bizarre and clearly wrong factors as nihilism, the lack of gender equality, gender mixing, illiteracy, and the supposed ability of one man to hijack the Quran from the remaining 1.3 billion people in his religion. A close reading of bin Laden's words would unquestionably offend the presentist's optimistic view of the secular world triumphing over superstitious religion. And so they have ignored the appeal of these words to tens and even hundreds of millions of Muslims, much to the detriment of Western security, economic vitality, and prospects for peace. Because many of the essential bin Laden-related books lack a thorough assessment of the primary documents, it is worth looking at a few of the concepts that are now accepted more or less as common wisdom about bin Laden and al-Qaeda and their war, which have emanated from the books. These pieces of common wisdom support an optimistic view of America's battle with al-Qaeda and its allies that I have found wither to inaccuracy after a comprehensive assessment of the sources. In short, there is nothing to substantiate these pieces of common wisdom in the primary documents. Let me go through several of them. First, I think we've all heard this innumerable times. Americans are hated and attacked by Islamic militants for their freedom and their lifestyle. In more than 800 pages of primary documents, there is no focus whatsoever on how Americans live and think. The focus is squarely on what the United States government does in the Muslim world. To be sure, bin Laden makes it clear that no Muslim state run by him or other Islamists would look like Canada. But neither does he raise rage against primaries in Iowa, women in the workplace, or after-work pictures of Sam Adams, knowing that almost no Muslim would risk his life to end these practices. This fact is perhaps the most important takeaway for ordinary Americans from bin Laden's papers, because it both lays bare how consistently they have been lied to by the last three presidents and explains why they do not understand that the enemy their nation is fighting is motivated by the impact of Washington's foreign policy in the Muslim world. And I use the lie deliberately. I use the word lie deliberately, because the data needed to expose the lie is so easily accessible that the U.S. bipartisan political leadership, so many of whom were educated in the Ivy League, have no ground for claiming ignorance. Their knowingly false description of the motivation of America's Islamist enemies may be politically expedient, but it most certainly is a lie that will ultimately lead to spiraling defense costs, domestic violence in the United States, severely curtailed civil liberties, and an endless war with Islam. The second piece of common wisdom is that bin Laden's mind was shaped by the most radical modern Islamic theorists, men such as the Egyptian Sayyid Qutb. Qutb is a theorist of jihad that made war look like a Hobbesian war of all against all, and he is seen in the West as the principal shaper of bin Laden's thought and actions. Larry Wright's Pulitzer Prize winner spent an entire chapter at the beginning of the book explaining Qutb's impact on bin Laden. But in the corpus of bin Laden's own work, there is not a single quotation from any of Qutb's works, nor does bin Laden ever mention the man's name. That bin Laden accepts some of what Qutb said is clear. As long as Qutb and others like him does not stray from the Salafist view of the Quran and the Sunnah as the primary documents of Islam, bin Laden concurs with him. But this is really no more than saying that the Quran and the Sunnah are central to bin Laden and most Muslims. When Qutb diverges from these sources, bin Laden clearly has no use for his recommendations and does not deign to even mention him. The idea that a direct line can be drawn from Qutb's often heretical interpretation of Islam and bin Laden's traditional Salafism simply cannot be substantiated. By studying and analyzing Qutb and most other 20th century theorists of jihad, We learn much about the radicalizing milieu in which bin Laden was reared, but almost nothing about the mature bin Laden's thought and motivation. And one of the reasons we do not understand the breadth of bin Laden's appeal is because we seek such sources of his thought beyond the Quran and Sunnah, which are immediately recognizable and dearly beloved to Muslims from Malaysia to Morocco to Montreal. I might stop for a moment and describe Salafism. In the Sunni faith, Salafism is, I think, easy enough to understand if you think of our own countrymen who look to the founders for original intent. In the Salafi tradition, the Prophet's sayings and traditions and the Quran are the primary documents, and that's where at least Salafists look exclusively for guidance and for direction in how to fight a war, how to run a government, how to run your life. The third piece of common wisdom is that bin Laden is not a very smart fella, and the Egyptian Ayman al-Zawahiri is really the eminence grise. Western politicians and writers often refer to al-Zawahiri, the former chief of an Egyptian terrorist group and now al-Qaeda's deputy leader, as bin Laden's brain. An examination of bin Laden's work, however, reveals no significant impact by the Egyptian on his thought or his rhetoric. Indeed, such an assessment clearly delineates how far bin Laden has drawn Zawahiri away from his original positions and strategy. Before joining bin Laden, for example, al-Zawahiri opposed attacks on the United States and championed attacks first on Egypt and then on Israel. As with Qutb, bin Laden never once quotes from al-Zawahiri's massive corpus of work in his own statements, but stands with him as long as the Egyptian sticks to the above-mentioned foundational documents of Islam. It is worth noting that bin Laden appears to have little use for self-taught Islamic scholars, like the English major Qutb, the surgeon al-Zawahiri, or the Egyptian electrician turned Islamic theorist Muhammad al-Faraj. His respect is reserved for those scholars who have received a formal education in a religious university or by private study with Salafi scholars, men such as Abdullah Azam. Ironically, bin Laden does not even refer in his prose or his rhetoric to the Salafist scholars he most respects. There's no need, really, to do that. By simply quoting the Quran and the Sunnah, he is, in essence, quoting those scholars, but putting credit where it belongs, into the mouths of Allah and the Prophet Muhammad. A fourth piece of common wisdom is al-Qaeda is outside the acceptable parameters of Islam and champions a heretical form of Islam called takfirism. A takfiri is one who believes he can decide for himself whether another Muslim is a good Muslim or not a good Muslim. And if he makes the decision negatively, the individual is open for being killed or robbed of his property. In bin Laden's work, there is nothing but a thorough and unequivocal denunciation of Takfiri doctrine. He repeatedly and effectively attacks those, especially Saudi regime spokesmen, who identify him and al-Qaeda as a Takfiri group. That said, bin Laden clearly recognizes and respects the massively negative impact on al-Qaeda if the Saudis or others succeed in making the Takfiri label stick. Bin Laden and his lieutenants seldom deign, really, to respond to criticism or accusations from Western states or Arab tyrannies. But when accused of takfirism, he, al-Zawahiri, and other senior al-Qaeda lieutenants have been quick to rebut the accusations. Bin Laden clearly and accurately foresees oblivion for al-Qaeda and its allies if the Muslim masses come to believe that they are indeed takfiris. His concern is evident in that he twice used public statements to implicitly apologize to all Muslims for the takfiri behavior of a man named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, al-Qaeda's late leader in Iraq, and to assure Muslims that such actions would not occur again, and to publicly and explicitly order all al-Qaeda fighters to avoid takfiri actions. The fifth piece: bin Laden and al-Qaeda are running from rock to rock and cave to cave, and so have no central control over their organization. To test this claim, let's again look at the just-mentioned and now-dead al-Qaeda chief in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. As noted, al-Zarqawi's murderously takfiri behavior in Iraq has been the only potentially fatal strategic threat to al-Qaeda since 9/11. Indeed, if the U.S. military did not kill him, al-Qaeda would have found a way to dispose of him, either by promoting him to a position where he could not command fighters or by killing him themselves. Indeed, the relative ease with which U.S. interrogators claim to have elicited al-Zarqawi's location from a captured close associate is astounding and raises the possibility that al-Qaeda directed the man to allow himself to be captured and then provide targeting data during his interrogation. Aside from this substantial but temporary damage that done by al-Zarqawi to al-Qaeda's position in Iraq and to the group's Muslim world standing, bin Laden's handling of what can be called the al-Zarqawi problem demonstrated his indirect management style. Always avoiding public disputes with lieutenants and allies is always a priority. And the continuing hierarchical nature of al-Qaeda and its ability to command forces outside of Afghanistan and Iraq. Bin Laden did not take on al-Zarqawi in public, but assigned that job to al-Zawahiri and another senior figure known only as Atiya to bring al-Zarqawi back on al-Qaeda's non-Takfiri reservation. He stressed that al-Zawahiri did so in a measured but clearly pointed manner. He stressed that al-Qaeda's respect for al-Zarqawi's success in killing Americans and their allies was great, but told al-Zarqawi that he was part of a bigger whole that had an international agenda which was being damaged by his actions, especially by televised beheadings and the bombing of mosques and shrines. When al-Zarqawi took minimal remedial action, Atiya followed with a much harsher letter. It opens by saluting al-Zarqawi's lethal accomplishments against U.S.-led forces, but then harshly chastises him for ignoring the fact that he is subordinate to bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders, demanding that his actions must complement, not retard, al-Qaeda's international goals, and pledging to him that he would be removed from commanding al-Qaeda in Iraq if he did not quickly fall into line behind the directions of al-Qaeda's senior leadership. The content of both letters, as well as al-Qaeda's ongoing rebound in Iraq, ought to give pause to the authors who have identified al-Qaeda as either a non-centralized organization, now isolated from independent affiliates, or as a doctrinally takfiri organization. These authors are largely mistaken and have skewed the now losing U.S. military's understanding of its Islamist enemies, as well as the doctrine our military has shaped to defeat them. The sixth, the claim that's widely spread, including in today's papers in the Wall Street Journal and at CNN, that al-Qaeda has failed. After reviewing bin Laden's words, it is irrefutably clear that he has always intended al-Qaeda's primary role to be that of inciting and instigating Muslims to drive America from the Muslim world, to attack Israel, and to overthrow Arab tyrannies, and not as a military machine meant to defeat Islam's enemies by itself or in alliance with a few other groups. Thus, the whole concept hawked by self-serving Western politicians that they have made Western populations safer because they have not been attacked since 9/11, reflects not only wishful thinking, but a singular ignorance of al-Qaeda's goals and the expanding power of its media operations. At 9/11, for example, al-Qaeda's main planning, training, and operational platform was in Afghanistan. As the second month of 2011 ends, the group retains part of that platform and has added a large section of Pakistan and sections of Yemen, Iraq, Somalia, and North Africa. In addition, al-Qaeda's example of hurting the United States and then not only surviving, but growing in numbers and expanding geographically, has been an inspiration for continuing or increased organizational activity and or violence by Islamist fighters in the North Caucasus, in southern Thailand, in Europe, across the Far East, in Kashmir, the Arabian Peninsula, India, Nigeria, and other places in Africa, and in the United States. In short, al-Qaeda not only retains substantial military capabilities for a group of its limited size, but it has developed an outsized media and geographical reach. In terms of inspiration and instigation capabilities, al-Qaeda is today exactly what bin Laden intended it to be, an unqualified success in inspiring Muslims to wage jihad against their governments and Western powers across the Islamic world. Today, al-Qaeda probably is about where bin Laden expected it to be, given his clear expectation of a multi-generational struggle and his frequent frustrated and chiding remarks to the many Muslim males who have not yet picked up a gun. Seventh and finally, Muslim world polling shows that bin Laden is no longer popular and that al-Qaeda is irrelevant. Not surprisingly, many non-Muslim authors place high value on the results of polling by reputable Western firms in the Muslim world, and some of it is indeed very valuable. But the poll's celebrity measuring or personality-based questions, such as do you approve of Osama bin Laden, or would you want to live under a bin Laden government, are virtually worthless. They disguise reality and give hope where there should be little or none. Today's low positive responses to such questions, for example, would skyrocket tomorrow if al-Qaeda attacks successfully in the United States or in Israel. The key polling questions are the ones that mesh with what bin Laden identifies as the motivation for jihad and with what he wants to achieve. Questions such as, what do you think of U.S. foreign policy? Do you want to be governed with a large measure of Sharia law? And do you believe that your current government is un-Islamic, has failed, and or is oppressive? Elicit the most informing responses. Polling shows virtual, unanimous hatred among Muslims for the impact of U.S. foreign policy and for current Muslim governments, and a large majority favoring a substantial measure of Sharia law in their governance in the future. These results, moreover, are nearly the same among key cohorts, young and old, male and female, and militant and moderate. As long as these results remain consistently high for protected periods in these cohorts, as they have for a decade, bin Laden is on the right track for his own purposes. Indeed, his refusal to use public words to build his own celebrity and his use of them to focus unrelentingly on al-Qaeda's war aims and on inciting Muslims to join the jihad is nothing short of genius. As noted, none of this means that Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and their Islamist allies are 10-foot-tall enemies, although bin Laden himself is clearly a world-changing individual. Haunting contemporary proof that history is made and changed for better or worse, by individuals and ideas and not by anonymous social and economic forces. Indeed, with any kind of a manly Western response, both al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden could have been eliminated at almost any time between bin Laden's declaration of war in 1996 and mid-1999. That, of course, did not happen, mostly because of the inferior and timid quality of Western political and military leadership. What a reading of the primary bin Laden documents does suggest, however, is that 15 years into this war bin Laden is waging, the West's understanding of its Islamist enemy's leader and his goals is at best marginal, because its political leaders, the Western leaders, have failed to read what he has said, to accept it that his motivation and the motivation of his followers is what he says it is, and to recognize that he intends to do what he has said he will do. This reality is especially troubling as there is no doubt that the U.S., British, and other Western intelligence services have provided their elected and civil servant superiors with detailed analyses of bin Laden's words ever since he declared war, and that these analyses surely contradict, if not ridicule, the popular "they hate us for our freedom" mantra still often stated by political leaders. Thinking back nearly 90 years, the West last made this kind of deliberate error when it failed to read, but readily scorned and ridiculed as ranting, the published words of a highly decorated but then jailed former corporal in the Kaiser's army. Now as then, I think it would be wise to follow the timeless guidance of another man who intended and came closest to destroying the United States. The better rule, Robert E. Lee once wrote, is to judge our adversaries from their standpoint and not from our own. It is always proper to assume the enemy will do what he said he will do and what he should do. Thank you very much. And I do apologize. I have a sore throat, and I've been talking a lot, so I'm sorry about the skips.
For our radio and internet audience, Michael Scheuer has been discussing his new book, Osama Bin Laden. And it is now time for us to take questions from our audience here. You can tell that there are a tremendous number of questions. But first, I would like to particularly welcome students from De Anza College and Skyline High School. I'm Nancy Jarvis, former chair and current trustee of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, and I will act as moderator during the question and answer period. In the acknowledgments for your book, you mention appreciation of young Marine and Army NCOs and junior officers you have helped train. What are you telling them that will help them in Iraq and Afghanistan?
We provide a course which immerses people, I guess is the word, in the culture of the enemy. In my experience over the course of my career in government, but with both the military and the intelligence services, we are very good at training our young people, telling them they have the best training, the best arms, that God's on their side, that they have movie star good looks, and the great support system. But we very frequently don't tell them that the enemy both has a brain and a voice, a vote, rather, in what's going to happen. When you hear, for example, an American or a British general say, we'll stay in Afghanistan for 20 years or however long it takes, implicit in that is the enemy really doesn't have a vote in what happens. And I think that's a dangerous thing. So what we do is bring in 20 or 30 or 40 people at a time, and for 8 to 10 days, they are the mujahideen. They dress in the clothes. They pray 5 times a day. They take instruction in the Quran, in the Sunnah. They take a bit of language instruction. They learn how to construct IEDs, to do beheadings, to create ambush sites, generally to do what insurgents do. My role is a minor one. They bring me in to play the role of Al-Qaeda's intelligence chief. And my job is basically to present to them the idea that the same database, basically, of information is available to the United States and to its enemies, and that the same information can be processed in a very different way. We process it in a way that makes it look often like our victory is inevitable. The same information can be adopted by the enemy to look as if they're winning. And the goal is simply to leave the young NCO or the junior officer with the idea that the enemy has a brain and a vote, and that's the basis of the project. I think we're a little bit late coming to it, as a matter of fact.
Where is Bin Laden now?
I think that the joke or the glib answer is we have him trapped in South Asia. My own idea of where he is if you look at him, if we had a map of Afghanistan north of the city of Jalalabad, on the Afghan side of the border, there are two provinces, Konar and Nuristan, and on the Pakistani side of the border, there's a district called Bajur. It is the area that's probably the most remote and mountainous in Afghanistan. It is also a place where bin Laden wanted to go in 1997 to live. But as he was preparing to move, the Taliban invited him to move to Kandahar. And so he thought he could not refuse what was obviously going to be the next government. And so he went to Kandahar. It is also the place in the Pak-Afghan area where Saudi, Kuwaiti, and Emirati missionaries have been very active over the past 30 years. And so it's a very congenial place to him religiously. So if I had to guess, that is where I would guess he would be, living a fairly sedentary life. If he was running from rock to rock and cave to cave, he'd be dead. People make mistakes when they move in transporting themselves or using the wrong roads or making a mistake in communications.
In your opinion, what more must be done to capture or kill bin Laden? More drone strikes in Pakistan? More black op teams?
No, I think we've proven that two things aren't going to work. One is law enforcement, and the second is a continuation along the line of Mr. Rumsfeld's rather absurd reliance on tools that are meant to be complements to military force. Mr. Rumsfeld using them as military force in their place. And I mean special forces, drones, the rendition program I ran at the agency, other CIA covert operations. I think the primary reason we don't have bin Laden is because our men and women in uniform in Afghanistan have been treated, I believe, very much with the dirty end of the stick. We have 100,000 soldiers, Marines, in Afghanistan. One in three are shooters. So we have 33,000 combat troops in a country bigger than Texas that has the highest mountains on Earth. Their jobs are to keep Karzai in power, to help build a democracy, to rebuild the economy, to build a transportation and communications infrastructure from scratch, to defeat the Taliban, to eradicate the world's largest and most violent heroin industry, and in their spare time go after bin Laden and al-Qaeda. I would suggest that we don't have enough troops in that country right now to do one of those things, let alone all seven of them. So I think that's probably the main reason why bin Laden is alive. He also lives among people who admire him as a hero in religious terms. And he lives with tribes who once accept you as a guest will defend you with their lives. So if you add all those things up, I think it would be a surprise that if we did get him.
Why is democracy so disdained by al-Qaeda?
I don't think it's disdained by just al-Qaeda. I think it's disdained in most of the Muslim world, if you're talking about a secular democracy. The entire Muslim world has no separation between church and state. And I think the mistake is not that they disdain it, but that we expect it to take hold in a place, whether in 10 years in Afghanistan or 18 days in Egypt. If I can digress for a moment, I think it's emblematic of our shipwreck of an educational system that what we've accomplished here in North America basically over 800 years since Runnymede in 1215, we expect to be able to plug into Egypt or Afghanistan or Iraq in 6 days or 6 weeks or six decades. I think it's more our expectation of people turning away from a faith toward an alien ideology that makes you question the worth of our educational system. One would have thought Mr. Bush should have been laughed out of the office by suggesting we could give a CD-ROM with our experience on it to Karzai or Maliki and say, here you go, set up a new Chicago or whatever. It's an absurd idea. Democracy in Islam, legislation governing laws are God's responsibility, not man's. In democracy, of course, in our country, we decide by vote or by human participation in making laws. And so the idea that democracy is the voice of the people making law really usurps from God his role, his responsibility.
Which is more important, that bin Laden be captured or that he remain free to focus the public's fears of terrorism?
I think it's important that he dies. I don't think we want to capture him. I hope we learned from the example of Saddam that when you find the hole in the ground, you throw a grenade and then ask if everybody's okay. The idea of having him speak on CNN or Al Arabiya or Al Jazeera for 3 years from the Southern District of New York is vastly undesirable. I think he's not alive to keep scaring Americans. Our politicians do that. In both parties, they've done it at least for the last four presidencies. What I've tried to explain tonight in some stammering way, and hopefully more fluently in my book, is that what our presidents have told us have been lies. It's simply not true that Al-Qaeda and its allies are going to blow themselves up because there's so many women in this audience tonight, or because we like alcohol, or because the Iowans have early primaries. There's nothing more absurd in the world than that, but yet it's expedient, because what politician wants to go to the American people and say, we're going to send your sons and daughters overseas to protect oil in the Saudi police state? That's not a vote winner. I think our problem lies at home. This is not an enemy that cannot be defeated, at least at this point in time, but it surely will never be defeated if we keep fighting an enemy that doesn't exist. And that entirely is up to us in terms of finding a statesman instead of a politician to serve in the White House.
You mentioned Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Would the American people better understand the Muslim world if they had easy access to those television networks?
I think they would indeed have a better appreciation, at whatever the reporting was, a better appreciation for how different the Muslim world is from our world. I remember during the invasion of Iraq, Mr. Rumsfeld kept getting very angry that Al Jazeera had an Arabic point of view. And I often wondered what would cause that sort of reaction. I didn't think he thought Fox would have a Yugoslavian point of view. It would certainly portray what we're doing in a different manner, and inherently it would be anti-American in many ways. But it used to be in the United States that you cast your net very broadly and then made your own decisions. I'm very much against any kind of anything that represses free speech, whether Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya merit praise is one thing, but certainly it can't hurt anyone, I don't think, to have a second opinion. The only thing I might worry about is the impact on the U.S. Muslim community, especially on young men and women, because people attacking the Israelis or attacking the United States are often characterized on those channels as something as heroes.
Why do you think the government won't admit that we're partly fighting the war for control of natural resources like oil?
Well, I think you very seldom find people eager to say, sorry, we failed for 40 years since the first embargo to do anything but move daylight savings time up 3 weeks. It's a tragedy that's unfolding today. I think what we're witnessing in the Middle East today is a graphic demonstration of American impotence. We cannot leave or get out of the way as long as we need and our allies need oil from the Persian Gulf. And certainly, whenever you raise that today, people say, well, we can't do something immediately. It'll take years. I said, well, yeah, but 40 years have gone by, or 38 years. It seems to me our whole position in the Middle East is locked tight until we do something about oil and energy. And to me, that means alternative energies. It probably means nuclear energy. It certainly means more exploitation of fossil fuels. At the end of the day, there's nothing on the Arab Peninsula worth the life of a Marine except for oil. And if the Congress doesn't get off its duff, I'm afraid on this issue and some other issues, we may be coming to a point in our own history where only calamity can change things in the United States. And maybe what we're seeing unfolding is going to be one of those calamities that produce a bit of sanity.
We have lots of questions on the current shockwaves across the arc of countries from Iran to Morocco. So let's deal with a few of those. What is the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda?
The relationship has been a very rocky one because the Brotherhood moderated its language and also made dormant its military apparatus, which was taken especially by Zawahiri as a traitorous sellout to Mubarak. Of course, in order to exist in Egypt and not be shot by Mubarak, they had to temper their rhetoric and they had to put their military forces in a dormant state. But the Brotherhood is an old established firm. Its goals are much like al-Qaeda, to spread Islam or to return Islam to power in the Middle East. It has chapters in virtually every Middle East country. It's been active in most European countries, Canada and the United States, for the past 35 or 40 years. It is indeed an organization like the Saudi government that is an offensive organization in the sense of deeming the world a project to turn into an Islamic globe, much more offensive and I think subversive certainly than Osama bin Laden, who is in many instances a defensive fighter. But the Brotherhood at the end of the day is a very effective organization and will have a say, or more than a say, in whatever comes next in Egypt. And it's always, frankly, it's been hard for me to discern how much of a difference there is between the Brotherhood and al-Qaeda, or is it primarily a war between al-Zawahiri, who hates the Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood?
You disagreed with the commentary that al-Qaeda has been sidelined by the uprisings, but there are several more questions from the audience on that. How do you expect bin Laden and his followers to react to what is currently happening in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East? How will the uprising in North Africa, specifically Egypt, as Mubarak is often a target of scrutiny, impact al-Qaeda's narrative?
I've written that the reaction of bin Laden and al-Qaeda, if it's allowed in the strictures of their religion, could be described as the happy dance. The two main enemies that al-Qaeda identified in 1996 did not include the United States. The United States was simply in the way. Their main enemies are Israel and the tyrannies that govern the Muslim world. And so when I read the Wall Street Journal or Peter Bergen this morning at CNN, and somehow this unrest in the Muslim world has made al-Qaeda irrelevant, I have to wonder, either I'm completely wrong or they are a bit off the mark. Take Egypt, for example. Mubarak was the most potent, the most effective anti-Islamist organization in the Muslim world. He's gone. Whoever takes his place is going to be, by definition, I think, because nothing has developed in Egypt in terms of political parties except for the Brotherhood, is going to be a weaker government. It's going to be influenced, at least influenced, by the Muslim Brotherhood, and therefore it's going to be less friendly toward the Israelis. It probably will not initially break the treaty, but it's not going to be as effective or want to be as effective in controlling the border with Gaza. And it's very unlikely that any successor government to Mubarak is going to be willing to shoot and kill Egyptians who want to help Palestinians. So without any manifest, apparent contribution to what happened in Egypt, the beneficiaries are those Islamists who have fought for al-Qaeda, with al-Qaeda, or are allied with al-Qaeda. It seems to me to argue against that is a strange situation. And, of course, the advantage now, or the question now, is how do you exploit an opportunity that has been put on your plate without any effort on your own part or expenditure of resources? And I would say that in Egypt or in Tunisia, where chaos or near chaos or potential violence, a well-organized small organization has a distinct advantage. If you recall, a gentleman named Lenin was able to do miraculous things with a very small organization in an environment where few other groups were organized. So I think it's a mistake in North. The question to think that al-Qaeda is somehow irrelevant or won't benefit from what has happened. North Africa, without what's happened in Tunisia and Libya, was a very strong al-Qaeda base. In Algeria, spreading south to Mali, to Chad, to Mauritania. One would think, for example, that the downfall of Gaddafi, whenever that happens, will be a bonus, Al-Qaeda has always had a very strong component of Libyans. The number three person in the senior leadership now is a man named Abu Yahya al-Libi, who is a Libyan Islamic scholar. North Africa is increasingly looking from Morocco over to Egypt as a place where al-Qaeda can build a very strong presence, along with other Islamic groups that have been fighting Gaddafi's government, the Tunisian government, or Egypt. I think we forget that the United States' position in the Middle East has been dependent for 50 years on the maintenance of tyranny. That's falling apart. And what takes its place is not going to be very influenceable, if there's such a word, by Americans. And we're also watching, as all of this unfolds in the Middle East, an enormous reinforcement of al-Qaeda and other Islamist groups through the opening of jails. I think Americans probably are not aware that most of the people in jails in Egypt are, or in Tunisia, or in Morocco, or in Algeria, or Libya. There are, of course, a lot of murderers and rapists and thieves, but primarily it's Islamic firebrands. It is people who would support al-Qaeda or another Islamic group who have been in jail. And I've read in the paper just in Egypt alone, 17,000 to 40,000 of these people were released from prisons during the protests. So nothing is perfect good news. But again, I'm not in the mainstream on this, but I think that it's hard to see anything but benefit for al-Qaeda from what's happening across the Middle East.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one last question. I apologize to those of you whose questions I could not present to Michael Scheuer. Could we say that bin Laden, to date, has won? After all, the United States and other nations have spent billions to counter his actions, and we spend hours going through metal detectors and taking off our shoes at airports. If he does nothing else, he has forced a major shift in our society.
I'm not sure if we could say he won, but I think from his own point of view, his mission is accomplished in the sense that much of the Muslim world is alienated from the United States and an increasing number of people are picking up weapons. I would say, indeed, to go back to the point I tried to make, no one has affected American life in the last 50 years in a negative sense more than Osama bin Laden. How we think about our government, is it too intrusive? Is it spying on us? How we think of local police? How we look at our neighbors? Is that a Muslim living down the street? I think it's a very dangerous situation. And I would also add that America may be in a unique historical position. If we get attacked again as seriously as 9/11 or more seriously, we have nothing that our military can respond to that will make a difference militarily. We have destroyed all of, I have to believe, all of the infrastructure, all of the physical targets that we know of al-Qaeda and its allies. And so we'd be kind of faced with either standing here quivering with rage but impotent to do anything, or I guess the knee-jerk response would be to attack Iran no matter who attacked us. Or we could attack population centers in Pakistan and Afghanistan, or we could destroy Mecca and Medina. But all of those would just really make Professor Huntington's prediction of a clash of civilization seem very, very prescient. So this is a very serious thing. I think the biggest danger of another 9/11 from 9/11 forward has been a government attacked severely in its own country has to do something. And I would what I have always feared is that because there is no viable overseas target to respond to, that we double down on ourselves. We'll have identification cards, we'll be frisked or looked at to go on the train or on buses or on the subway. The government will be much more. My own view is that if we get attacked during this administration, in a way more severe than 9/11, I think Mr. Obama will make George Bush look like an ACLU lawyer. Not because he wants to do it, but because a government has to respond to protect its people. And because it can't do it militarily overseas, it will do it here at home.
On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club, we thank Michael Scheuer, former chief of the Central Intelligence Agency Bin Laden Unit and author of the book Osama Bin Laden. The book is urgent and chilling. I commend it to all of you. We also thank our audience here tonight, as well as those listening via radio and the Internet. Good night to all.